from the Gettysburgian and 91.1 WZBT Gettysburg. I'm Jamie Welch, and this is On Target.
I'm Ben Ponce. Today on Target, we'll discuss reflections from the Freedom of Expression Town Hall and a mold issue cropping up in one first-year residence hall.
Jennifer Bloomquist is our featured guest. Stay with us.
All right, well, let's get right into it with some three breaking stories that have been coming out within the last couple of days. It's Friday evening as we record this. Yesterday, the college held a Freedom of Expression town hall in which members of the campus community discussed the draft statement of institutional philosophy. Also, then last night, into the wee hours of this morning, so late Thursday night into Friday morning, two units from the Gettysburg Borough Police confiscated up to three bags purportedly of controlled substances from Paul Hall, and one student is under investigation, possibly more than one. We don't really know at this point. We believe one student is under investigation pursuant to that matter. And also, we just received word as we were preparing to come on the air that Hanson Hall, over on the east quad of the first-year residential complex here at Gettysburg, has mold issues. We already knew that there were mold issues in the basement. However, upon the completion of an inspection by an environmental consultant, the college has made the decision to begin remediation work immediately, as opposed to at the end of the semester, which was the previous plan. As such, residents on the first, second, and third floors will be required to temporarily move to the basement once remediation is completed there for approximately 2 weeks. So all kinds of breaking headlines coming out. Jamie, why don't we start with the Freedom of Expression Town Hall? And I was just curious what reflections or what your biggest takeaways were from the presentation and the ensuing discussion.
I think that one of the most interesting things for me was when Dean Bloomquist came to the defense of the conservative students who were speaking, and you know, because the people who commented were pretty much all members of YAF, the Young Americans for Freedom, and they were concerned about some language around harassment that in another policy that they were tying back in with this policy and with this philosophy. But you know, she, Dr. Bloomquist was really careful to say that she wants this philosophy to not only protect minority students, but also those students who were not traditionally considered to be marginalized groups, like conservatives and Republicans, who feel that that their speech is not welcome at Gettysburg College right now.
Yeah, that certainly is the case. And in fact, we interviewed Jennifer Bloomquist. I interviewed Jennifer Bloomquist for this podcast yesterday afternoon. We'll play that interview later in the program. And I asked her about that very question. And I think that her answer was quite intriguing. I won't spoil it right now. But you're certainly right that that was the case. There were six total commenters, all students, during the open forum part of it. Four were, as you said, members of YAF. The other two, one person asked a question about whether more data could be made available regarding the input the work group received, and the other student was an international student who kind of cited how he's come to engage with the issue of freedom of expression since coming to the United States, and also plugged a philosophy house he's working to create.
Yeah, it was definitely a shameless plug. I know everybody thought that was quite shameless, but it did kind of tie in. I mean, it's philosophy house, and we were talking about a philosophy. So, I thought that was very clever of him to and kind of smart, because you had an audience of 130 people there. So, you know, definitely got your message out there for sure.
Yeah, one thing I thought was particularly interesting and arguably perhaps a little disappointing, and I know that Jennifer Blomquist felt the same way, was that among the attendees at this event, there was a majority, certainly a plurality, was college administrators and college support staff as opposed to students or even faculty. I know that the library made a strong showing. The College Life Office made a strong showing. And you know, I'd be intrigued, Jamie, to hear your take on whether the students are just not engaged around this issue, maybe the philosophy, they were relieved by the philosophy and didn't feel a need to come talk about it. What's your perception of that?
What I'm thinking is, I think that the student body as a whole, for the most part, felt that their voices had been heard during the previous listening tour that happened and at the previous town hall and student senate discussions, and that this philosophy really reflects, you know, something that they support. So they didn't feel the need to come and talk about it at the town hall. So I think really my personal opinion is that students that support it don't feel the need to come and speak in support of it because they already think that it's great and, you know, that they don't need to reach out about any changes. So that's why we heard from the students who feel that it didn't go far enough. So I think that that's why we didn't hear people coming out in support. It's just simply because they already do support it and they didn't feel the need to come and spend an hour and a half at a town hall.
Yeah, that may be a fair point. You know, I thought it was kind of interesting that they scheduled this town hall in the middle of the day as opposed to in the evening. I'm sure that was to allow, you know, staff members to take part.
Yeah, well, this is technically the common hour. So Thursday, 11:30 to 1 is supposed to be a time when there's no classes or labs. We all know some people do have classes or labs at that time, but it's supposed to be a time when there's no classes or labs. It's when traditionally a lot of colloquiums are scheduled also. And I know that at least the computer science department was programming against this town hall, and I'm sure other departments were as well. So that could have also contributed to the lack of student engagement.
Yeah, that's possible. So just in terms of process moving forward, the Student Senate is the next group to weigh in after the comment period ends, and Student Senate will vote, and then faculty will vote, and then the Board of Trustees will vote at its May meeting. Jamie, you went to yesterday afternoon's faculty meeting and came away with an interesting scoop there. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so Dr. Randall Wilson, who is a professor in the Environmental Studies Department, stood up toward the end, of the discussion period and asked, basically called into question the whether the Student Senate is truly representative of the entire student body, and said, and asked if it might be a better idea to cast a wider net, is the language that he used, and have the entire student body vote for or against the philosophy as in a referendum format. Blomquist said that she was basically that she didn't think it was a bad idea, and that we have the technology and it might even be something that we could look into doing. So that was certainly an interesting idea that we hadn't heard before, and it seems that Professor Blomquist is definitely open to that idea. She did walk it back a little bit and say, well, I don't know how that ties into student senate policies, and we'll have to talk with Jeff Foster, who's the associate vice president for college life, about that, since he works with Senate much more closely and would know the policies and constitution there.
Was there any, aside from Blomquist or Wilson, was there any discussion for or against that idea at the faculty meeting?
It was a question that was posed right at the end. There were some nods of people that seemed to approve of that idea and thought it was a good idea. But for the most part, I think people were just trying to get out of there. You know, Thursday afternoon, it was almost 5 o'clock. But it definitely didn't seem to be that there were people that were opposed to it in the room that were, you know, making their displeasure known.
We've spoken with a couple members of Student Senate, two of whom were quoted in Jamie's article that was published yesterday. One of whom is Michael Mancuso, who last week on this podcast said he would enthusiastically vote in support of ratifying this statement of institutional philosophy. And he said basically that while he would not be opposed to a full student body referendum, he doesn't want to do one just for the sake of doing one. You also spoke to Luke Frigon, president of Student Senate, who seemed to not really support the idea that while he, you know, doesn't object in theory to students voting in a referendum format, that he thinks that Senate has been thoroughly engaged with this process and that the student body has had ample opportunity to weigh in, and so that he would just as soon have Senate cast the vote on behalf of the student body. I also spoke to a few other senators, some of whom were a little bit put off by the notion that Senate is not a representative body of the students, that you know, they're elected to do this job and that, you know, they should be able to do this job. And just in terms of process, from the Senate side, if Senate were to send it to a full student referendum, they would need 2/3 of the senators present to do that. And then the student body would have to approve the referendum by 50% plus one in order to, you know, approve it on behalf of the student body. So, you know, Jamie, do you think it's likely that this will go to a full vote of the student body? Like, you know, in terms of path forward, did you get the sense that they were seeking to do this independent of the student Senate process? Because basically, from the quotes we saw, it doesn't sound like there's a whole lot of appetite among senators themselves to send it to a full student body referendum. Would you agree that that's the case?
Well, I mean, certainly I don't think Student Senate wants to give up. I mean, this is their real chance to actually do something that has impact on the future of students here at Gettysburg, because often they're just seen as this, you know, bank that clubs go to get money. And they're not really seen as an actual governmental, like, governing body of the students. And so this is their big opportunity to really have a role. So I don't think they're going to give that up on their own. Now, the college really has no obligation to actually give it to Student Senate. They could just do an end run around Senate and do it on their own, like you said. Do I think that's going to happen? I don't think so. I mean, really, I don't think that it's going to go to a referendum unless there's a call from the student body for it to happen. Like, there needs to be, I think, people that want there to be a full referendum on this issue. And I just don't know if it's going to be there. I haven't really heard from people that are like gung-ho, like, we need to do this. So I think the chances of it going to a full vote of the student body is probably fairly low.
Yeah, I mean, I could also see how it might open. It could backfire to send it to a full student body referendum if, you know, they announce one process. It could be seen that, you know, the faculty, you announce one process, the faculty's not sure it likes where Senate is going to go with it, so faculty convinces college administration to, you know, end run and do a referendum vote that way to maybe get a different answer. I mean, I don't know that that would actually be the case, but certainly it could be seen that way. And in a process that I think universally, and that was one thing that really stood out at the meeting yesterday, was that regardless of what people felt on the statement, there was universal praise from the about the process from everyone who spoke and from President Riggs at the end as well. So, I mean, I think it could be seen as a rather sloppy end to an otherwise really well-done process.
Yeah, well, and that's something that Bloomquist said also during the – there was a question at the faculty meeting about, well, what happens if one of the bodies doesn't ratify – the philosophy. So if either the students or the faculty or the administrator or the trustees don't ratify, what happens from there? And she basically said, they're really hoping that everybody just ratifies it, because this represents, she said that this represents their best effort. And if it's not ratified by any group, then they've failed. And we need to either bring in other people to draft this philosophy, or she doesn't know what to do because this is their best effort. So she's basically laying it all down and saying that if this doesn't get approved, somebody else is going to need to do it because she's failed.
Well, that's interesting. I know that last week, Michael Mancuso said that he anticipates Senate will ratify it almost unanimously. Now, Nick Arbaugh, who was one of the folks who spoke up at the meeting in opposition to parts of the philosophies, announced that he will vote no, and he encourages his colleagues to do the same. So, I mean, we'll see. We'll see where that goes. I just think that, you know, the members of the work group that we've spoken to certainly are hoping for a smooth end to this process, that, you know, there's still roadblocks that could put that in doubt. All right. Why don't we move on to the next item on the agenda, which would be last night. An incident, a drug-related incident at Paul Hall. Jamie, can you kind of recap what we know so far to this point?
Yeah, so we know that around 11:30, between 11:15 and 11:30, we don't know the exact dispatch time, but DPS responded to a report of a smell of marijuana on the first floor of Paul Hall, in the west quad of the first-year residential complex at Gettysburg. And upon arriving, DPS also called in two units from the Gettysburg Police Department. So we had two officers from the Gettysburg Police Department. We had DPS there. What we know from students who were on the scene said that they did smell a very strong odor of marijuana outside the room. They did see officers removing three large brown paper bags that assumedly contained illicit substances of some sort of variety. We're not really sure what was in the bags. And we know that no one was arrested on scene that night. Officers left without arresting anybody. But we do know that the investigation with GPD is still ongoing, and arrests could be coming down the line at some point.
So, yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point. Jamie, I know you work for the Office of Residential Residential and First Year Programs.
Yeah.
And obviously you can't comment on specific incidents, not that you would know anything about this particular incident. But in your experience, in what sorts of situations do the police get called in like this, as opposed to them getting handled internally as a student conduct matter? Because I know there are some cases, and we publish the crime log every week, this is public information, that, you know, there'll be drug possession that shows up as a student conduct issue, but does not get referred to the police. What are the circumstances that make it rise to the level that police get involved?
So usually police involvement is the situations where you see a large, so if it's just marijuana, or just, so basically just alcohol, we like to handle that internally, unless it's some absolutely egregious violation. We really handle alcohol internally. Now, when it comes to marijuana, usually a personal use amount of marijuana is something that will be handled internally. DPS or the RFYP staff member will have the student dump it in the toilet, get rid of it after we finish documenting the situation, and then a conduct report will be generated and they'll be dealt with through the alcohol and drug point policy excuse me, that is laid out in the student handbook. Situations where we would call in the police department, and that's usually that's almost always DPS that does that. So we'll call DPS, and then DPS comes out and assesses if it needs to be referred to the police department. But usually it's something where you see a vast quantity of marijuana, something that would be along the lines of distribution amounts, or any kind of any hard drugs at all will involve a call to GPD. Now, normally when we call GPD, only one unit responds. So it is interesting that there were two units here. I'm not sure if they were just having a slow night or if it was bad enough that they needed two people. But like I said, there weren't any arrests, at least that we saw, of anybody from that scene.
Yeah, and so obviously we don't want to speculate too much or read any, you know, read into something that's not there. But it certainly seems that when, you know, GPD and GPS are responding to an incident, you know, at, almost at midnight, that it's more than just a routine thing, wouldn't you say?
I would definitely say, I mean, I don't want to speculate either, but I mean, I would say definitely if it was just somebody smoking a personal use amount of marijuana in the room, we probably wouldn't have needed two GPD units and three large brown bags.
Yeah. And so I just want to finish up this segment by reading a statement we received from Jamie Yates, the college's director of media relations, who said, quote, "There was a report of a marijuana odor in the hallway, which DPS responded to and began investigating the source. The investigation is still ongoing by borough police, but we can confirm it was an isolated incident and there are no safety concerns." That ends the quote there. So, I mean, certainly we'll be keeping an eye on this, watching to see if there are any charges filed, court proceedings. But, you know, it's not the first time that if this turns out to have been a drug bust of sorts, it's not the first time that would have happened on the college campus. I can think of two incidents in recent memory. There was the main line drug bust. Was that, how many years ago was that? And then last year,
that was four years ago now.
And yeah. Then last year there was the incident at the Science Center involving a student who was dealing drugs.
Absolutely, dealing a wide variety. I mean, it's the absolute size and breadth of the drug catalog that this person had at Science House was quite unbelievable. I'm not sure if we're dealing with a situation like that here. We don't know really what was in those brown bags. We just know that they exist. So when we hear more information, we will definitely let you all know what's going on.
Yeah, and then the last thing I want to get into it a little bit is the report of mold at Hanson Hall. So just to recap, traditionally, the basement of Hanson Hall, because it has only one restroom, is an all-female floor. So it's the only single-gender floor across campus. At least in first-year residential halls. I'm not familiar with any other ones.
I don't think
anywhere.
There are any other single. That is the only one that still exists. And I mean, they all used to be
right
separated out. They used to be separated out by building, but yeah, you know, not in recent years.
In any case, but earlier this semester, in fact, at the beginning of the semester, before students moved back in, I believe, residents of that basement were notified that mold had been discovered after an air quality test in the basement, so that those students would be relocated for the remainder of the semester. There were tests conducted on the first, second, and third floors where students also live, and those air quality tests did not determine a cause for concern. So those students were to remain there. The only real consequence for students remaining there was that they were going to have to do laundry in an adjacent building because the laundry room is in the basement. But the plan was the basement was going to be sealed, and that everyone would move on with their life for the remainder of the semester, and the college would address it over the summer. That's no longer the case. Today, Kira Kant, who is the Associate Dean of College Life overseeing residential and first-year programming, sent an email to Hanson Hall residents on the first, second, and third floors telling them that their situations were about to be affected too. After work with a consultant, an environmental consultant, the college has decided, I guess proceeding out of an abundance of caution, that they need to begin remediating issues now. So first, they will take care of the basement, and then they will move to the first, second, and third floors where a visual inspection indicated there was cause for concern. Now, air quality tests still determine that there are no issues on the first, second, or third floors, but you know, the college, I guess, proceeding out of an abundance of caution, doesn't want to take any chances. So the plan is that once the basement is remediated, they will move the first floor residents temporarily to the basement, remediate cleaning on the first floor, and then follow that same process on the second and third floors. They're anticipating that each of these will take about 2 weeks. And so they're hoping to be finished by the end of March. Kira Kant also mentioned in her email that they're committed to providing students support in moving things and to make it as unintrusive a process as possible. But obviously, anytime you have to move some of your stuff for 2 weeks, but only then to come back to where you were, it's just a headache.
No, I would definitely agree. And I mean, you know, it's certainly not fun to have to move. I can, you know, I have to move a lot here at Gettysburg, even though I've stayed here over the summer the past 2 years. It's still got to move from here to there and here to there, and it's just all over the place. So that's certainly not fun. And also, it's not fun knowing that you're living in a building that does have these moisture and mold issues, even if it may not be, you know, rising to the level of being uninhabitable according to Pennsylvania standards. I mean, certainly you don't want to be living in a space that has mold in it. And it also, to me, seems a little bit concerning that facilities allowed it to get so bad that we need mold remediation teams to come in. Why weren't inspections being done, or were they not being adequately done? That's something that we need to look into, such that the basement got so bad that they had to evacuate people from it at the beginning of the school year, of the semester. So that's just something to look at, is, you know, the role of facility services or what they did or did not do to help prevent mold from growing in the building.
Yeah, and so we reached out to Jamie Yates, again, the college's director of communications, and she said that she's working on our getting a response to us, but it will likely be tomorrow until she's able to do that. That email coming in literally as we speak. But I mean, certainly I agree that it's a concern, and you just have to wonder, is a lot of these residential facilities, particularly those first year residence halls, are getting to be older buildings. And, you know, in coming years, are there going to need to be large-scale capital projects to keep those buildings inhabitable for students? I mean, many, many colleges have newer dorm buildings, residential facilities than Gettysburg does. Certainly, it's not a reason most – the first-year dorm buildings are not a reason most people come to Gettysburg necessarily. But if there continue to be maintenance issues like this, you just have to wonder what the long-term approach to that is. How long can, you know, is this an isolated incident? Maybe. But you know, we know that there are many older buildings that, you know, constantly have various issues, you know, mostly minor issues. But it's something that the college, I think, is going to need to keep a close eye on in the coming weeks, the coming months, the coming years. Would you agree, Jamie?
I would definitely agree. I mean, for instance, 5 years ago, the college had to undergo a serious capital expenditure to get Gladfelter Hall updated. I mean, it looks great now, but back before it was renovated, they had all kinds of mold going on in the basement of Gladfelter Hall, and that required a significant investment of the college's capital to get that building back to where it needs to be and updated. And I mean, it's very nice now, but at the time, I mean, it was, you know, old building, and it was starting to get, you know, these issues, just like the residential facilities are now seeing. And
yeah, and so
that's very expensive to fix.
Right. And of course, Gladfelter Hall is an academic building, and there are certainly some aging academic buildings on campus too. I mean, aside really from Gladfelter and the Science Center, most of the buildings are getting pretty old. We're sitting here recording in the basement of Plank Gym in the WZBT studio, and I was actually just at the library yesterday, and someone was looking through an old yearbook from the early 1990s, and there was a picture of the basement of Plank Gym, and it looks exactly the same as it does now 25 years ago. And I mean, if there's nothing wrong with the building, then that's fine. But, you know, a lot of these more behind-the-scenes sort of maintenance issues are cropping up across campus. And we know that last year there were some issues out at Bogman Hall, out at the seminary. I mean, those seem to have been potentially an isolated rodent-related incident. Yeah, it's not really a structural maintenance issue.
Those are definitely, and there are other issues that happen out at the seminary with plumbing and things like that. That is a very old building. But that is also to be, we should note, not college controlled. The college does not have any responsibility for the facilities aspect of that building.
Well, right. I mean, it's just that, you know, even if, you know, if buildings here are in disrepair and they need, you know, to relocate students, it's just there aren't a whole lot of good options. And we know that the first year residential facilities are pretty much at capacity right now.
Right.
And you know, the college is just going to have to do a real careful analysis of, you know, how they're going to house students. And if the college wants to continue to grow and maybe 2,500 to 2,600 total students is where they want to stay, to keep that sort of small feel. But at the same time, you know, if they're losing places where students can reside each year, you know, calls into question the strategic and future planning of the college.
I mean, I would definitely say that some of the deferred maintenance that's been going on may be coming back to bite them, you know, as we come down the pike here. So certainly something that we're going to be keeping an eye on, and we're going to be following up with college officials about sort of the situation and how this situation in Hanson came to be. So definitely something we're going to keep you up to date on. And that wraps up our news segment. And now I think it's time for Ben Ponce to give us our bullet report.
And that's right. Last Saturday on January the 27th, the men's basketball team lost 70-64 to Swarthmore. The women's basketball team defeated Swarthmore, but the score got cut off for my page. Oh, no, it didn't. 89-39. I was there. I should have remembered. In any case, the wrestling team went to Washington and Lee and defeated the Generals 19-18 in Lexington. The wrestling team also defeated Johns Hopkins 22-13. On that same day. So honestly, I don't know if it was at Washington and Lee or at Johns Hopkins, but it was not at Bream Gym. In any case, the men's swimming team defeated Mary Washington 179-82, while the women's swimming team lost 150-112 last Saturday. The men's basketball team fell to Johns Hopkins 73-63 on Wednesday, and the women's basketball team won 65-61. They are having an excellent season, and we'll see if that continues when they play again next week. They're certainly positioning themselves for a potential centennial conference crown. The men's wrestling team will face the United States Merchant Marine Academy on Saturday. Remember, if you recall from last week's bullet report, that match was canceled due to the government shutdown. But they are back up and running at the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy. I actually have a friend who goes there, but I guess I should touch base with him regarding whether he experienced any issues due to the government shutdown. Of course, this is not at all related to Gettysburg sports, but just the kind of extraneous and exciting supplementary information we loyal listeners have come to expect from your favorite Gettysburg College-related news podcast, On Target.
Thus endeth the bullet report.
Thus indeed endeth the bullet report and the government shutdown report.
Well, thank you. That's our bureaucrat in training right there, Ben Ponce, more interested in the government shutdown than in the sports scores. We'll be right back with Jennifer Bloomquist.
Okay, and today we're joined by Jennifer Bloomquist, Associate Provost for Faculty Development, Dean of Social Sciences and Interdisciplinary Programs, and the Chair of the Freedom of Expression Work Group. Professor Bloomquist, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ben.
So we're recording this on Thursday afternoon at about 1:30, so it's just been about an hour since the town hall meeting that the Freedom of Expression Work Group hosted to discuss the draft statement of institutional philosophy that was released a couple of weeks ago. So I just wanted to kind of start by getting, you know, your immediate reaction to how you thought the town hall went, the turnout, and some of the comments that you've received so far.
Okay, well, thanks. I think the town hall, I think it went really well. We decided to host a town hall last semester, we had had a roundtable discussion with students. And after we did that, we realized that student expectations for that discussion were different than the work group's expectations. In that session, students sat at small tables and had discussions among themselves, and they really wanted an opportunity for an open forum to ask questions, to hear more about the process, to voice concerns. So at that point, we decided to host the town hall in response to that need that the students had. And we decided as early in the semester as possible would be a good idea. So we set it up for today. I think the turnout was pretty good. The room was set for 300 people. And I would say we probably got over 200. We've had some students who've been engaged in the process since the outset, and they were there. And my sense is that they appreciated the opportunity to respond to the draft philosophy, to state their concerns. They were very thoughtful. They have all along been very intelligent in their critiques. And I think that they gave the work group a lot of credit for all of the time and energy we've put into this. And I hope that the students, my sense from the town hall is that the students did seem to feel heard. And that is really, really important to me.
Mm-hmm. So you kind of talked about the turnout. One perception that I was actually sitting with a college administrator at the town hall, and that administrator said to me that it seemed like there were a lot of staff and administrators and maybe even outnumbering the students. Did you, anticipate that? And did you, agree with that perception? And if so, do you think that says anything about the level of student engagement in this process or the level of engagement from other constituencies that you've identified?
I think that I think that that assessment is probably correct. And at the end of last semester, if you had asked me who was going to show up, I would have predicted more students. But I think that once we sent the draft to the campus community, I think for many, many students and faculty, that this was no longer an issue. That they, whatever concerns they had about the philosophy, those were put to rest. And I think if the philosophy had been drafted differently, we may have had more students turning out. But I think that that might have been part of it. And I think that staff, college life staff and other staff tend to show up to these sort of town hall meetings because they have a different sense of duty. In terms of their responsibility to the institution. We didn't get any questions from any staff, even if the staff did outnumber students. All of our questions today came from students.
Mm-hmm. And, you kind of referred to it briefly there, the process that was used. And I know you talked about that at length at the town hall today. And I'll just mention that if anyone was unable to go to the town hall, there was video of it available on the Gettysburgians Facebook page. Can you just kind of, briefly review what that process looked like, the groups that you met with throughout the fall, and, how you kind of took all their feedback used that as you drafted the statement?
Sure. President Riggs asked if I would head up this work group at the beginning of the fall 2017 semester, and then she and I built the work group after that. She gave us our charge, which, is available in any number of areas, to come up with a philosophy that is reflective of our institutional values and articulated our commitment to freedom of expression. After that, we met as a group and we thought about other institutional philosophies that we thought had parts that were useful for us. We each brought a couple of those to the table, and we trimmed that list down to 6. We sent that list along with some guiding documents to the campus community. We made those available to everyone, letting everyone know this is sort of what we're thinking. We met with the Board of Trustees and had a roundtable discussion with them. And we replicated that with the faculty, and then we identified student stakeholder groups that we thought would be most interested or felt that they had the most to say about how we go about drafting the philosophy. These were groups that represented different political ideologies on campus, also groups that we identify on our website as cultural groups. And we also reached out to the Greek community. We contacted 15 student groups. And of those 15 student groups, I believe we met with 10 total. There are a couple we reached out to several times, but they never got us on their agenda. Which, you know, that's okay. The student groups that were really engaged were really very engaged and gave us great feedback. And so when we met with those student groups, two members of the work group went to each of the club meetings, and had conversations with them about their concerns, about our process, about our purpose. We talked about the fact that this is a philosophy and not a policy, and really what it meant and why the administration really felt that it was time for us to develop a philosophy. And after we met with all of those different stakeholder groups, we also had the student roundtable discussion that I mentioned to you earlier, because we really wanted to give all of the student groups on campus, all of the students, the chance to participate in this process. In addition to the faculty, trustees, and student groups, we met with communications and marketing. We also met with College Life, the administrative council, and the support staff council. We have tried to be as expansive as possible. We didn't want anybody on campus to feel that they were left out of developing this, because this is a community philosophy and we need it to be reflective of as many people on campus as we possibly could.
Mm-hmm. And so what sorts of feedback have you already received with respect to the draft that's come out, you know, either anecdotally, or I know there's a Google form set up, and I don't know if you've seen any of those submissions yet, but, you know, are you generally getting a sense that people are in support of or in opposition to the statement that was released?
So far we've gotten 15 responses from the Google form, and they've all been very positive. Everyone who's responded has appreciated the discussion of our institutional history. We've gotten comments that say that people can't imagine a better philosophy for our institution. We've had some good suggestions about other ways, you know, to edit or revise or add to the philosophy. So far, and even in, you know, and with the town hall today, students who have been slightly more critical or cynical about the process also, you know, really said very complimentary things about the philosophy. I think that there are a lot of people on campus who are just really relieved that that the philosophy came out the way that it did. And we've just been, you know, we've been really trying to be very careful and sensitive to what, you know, what campus constituents are interested in.
Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to kind of address one of those comments that was raised today at the town hall meeting. Several students mentioned specifically a clause towards the end of the philosophy that says, thus, the college may seek to restrict expression that, one, violates state or federal law or college policies on non-discrimination, two, constitutes slander, threats, or harassment, three, unreasonably invades individual privacy or violates confidentiality interests, or four, is directly incompatible with the functioning of the college. Could you just kind of talk about what led the committee to kind of hone in on those four potential areas of restriction, and whether there were you know, other policies that informed those decisions or legal considerations, or just how you kind of got to those four as, you know, the only, as near as I can tell, kind of explicit explicit comments as to what may be regulated or prohibited.
One and two and three are those are directly responsive to what freedom of expression can and cannot do. So those are ones that are typical of policies. I mean, that's you know, some legal language that you see across the board. Number four is what I think that students today had had some of the more pointed critiques of. And also, you know, in reasonably regulating time, place, and manner, Professor Bottery, who came to talk about the legal limitations of these things, that's addressed there as well. So I think that that those four are actually ones that are directly, you know, related to freedom of expression and need to be put in a philosophy to say that, you know, legally, this isn't something that's going to be protected, right? Like violating state and federal law. What some of the students seem to have to take issue with has to do with, I'm not sure if it's that part that you read there. I think it's the part at the very end. No, I think that maybe that is there. And it really has to do with some of our college policies that are already in place. And you know, this is a draft, and we are sensitive to the concerns that were raised today. And I think that it has to do, you know, they talked about harassment policy. Now, our harassment policy is something different than this philosophy. And if students have issue with the harassment policy, that's a different conversation. And we can, you know, this is still a draft. We're still working on it. And if students in general feel really strongly that that is too limiting, you know, that it's up for revision.
Mm-hmm. And based on, you know, what you've heard so far, would you anticipate any specific revisions on the horizon, you know, on anything you've heard either today or previously?
I think certainly the work group wants to take what we heard today under advisement. There is concern, you know, that we do want Student Senate to ratify this. That's the first leg of the ratification process is Student Senate. And if Student Senate, Nick Arbaugh mentioned today that Student Senate had already voted on language that states that, you know, Gettysburg College students, just because you're at a private institution doesn't mean that you should have different rights than students at a public institution. And I think that that if students do feel that some of that language at the end is in direct opposition to that, to their rights as Americans, I think that we do need to go back and revise that. This is not set in stone. We had the town hall so that we could take student and faculty and staff concerns under advisement. And so we plan on revisiting this philosophy. And we've got the 2-week talkback period. And so if we get comments that are similar, you know, I mean, we're still taking in, we're still on our listening tour.
It's a long listening
it's
tour.
It's very long.
And so one thing you just mentioned was that you know, the ratification process will include first Student Senate and then the faculty and then finally the Board of Trustees. I guess the Board of Trustees would probably look at this at their May meeting. I know they meet next weekend, but given the sequence that you're looking for, that so they will come last. If any one of those groups were to, you know, put it up for a vote and to vote no, what would happen from there? And you know, would revisions, I assume, be made? Or could this process, you know, become enshrined if even if Student Senate were to vote no?
That is not our intention. Our intention is that if Student Senate votes no, then we will have to revise the philosophy. It's very important that all of the groups on campus approve this as an institutional philosophy. And that's why we're starting with Student Senate in making this official.
Just kind of taking a step back, more broadly looking at the philosophy, and I know you mentioned earlier today at the town hall that you were hoping for a philosophy that would allow anyone from Angela Davis to Robert Spencer to speak at the college, and I know on the minds of many is, you know, the Robert Spencer scenario that happened last spring when Spencer, who's the director of a blog called Jihad Watch, came to campus to give a speech entitled The Political Ramifications of Islamic Fundamentalism. He was invited by the Young Americans for Freedom. The college subsequently invited Dr. Todd Green, an associate professor of religion at Luther College, to offer another perspective on that subject. And simultaneously with Robert Spencer's speech, there was a Muslim student solidarity rally. And so just kind of looking at how the college handled that and then looking at this philosophy, is there anything that you think in this philosophy would change how the college might handle a situation like that, or would this philosophy kind of support what the college did last spring?
I think that the college did a really good job with that event. I think that everything that was planned was just very sensitive and affirming for all of the student groups who had skin in the game. I don't think that this philosophy calls for anything different. And it is a philosophy. It's not, you know, it's not putting any policies in place. It really is just drafted to affirm our commitment to freedom of expression and to articulate the reasons that we uphold freedom of expression. So I don't think that the philosophy would have done anything, puts anything in place that would lead us to do anything different. And I'm, you know, I'm proud of the way that we handled that event, those series of events as an institution. We've all seen across the country how these things go horribly wrong, and I'm glad that as an institution, we, you know, all of us did a good job.
Mm-hmm. And so a minute ago, we kind of talked about one angle of kind of criticism that may come of this philosophy. On the other hand, and no one articulated this at the town hall today, but I imagine there are some people on campus who were hoping for a more, maybe restrictive isn't the right word, but a policy that would prohibit more sorts of offensive speech, or that would, you know, protect students who would feel intimidated by a speaker, such as maybe someone like Robert Spencer. Could you just kind of talk about, I know there's a line in the philosophy about the college's role isn't to shield people. Could you kind of talk about what informed that decision and where, you know, the members of the work group and where the work group stood on that issue?
Well, I think that the members of the work group, I think that the faculty in general, we all believe that education takes place when there is the free exchange of ideas. President Riggs met with Student Senate last semester, and a student did stand up and say, the college is supposed to protect us from this. And she said, I'm really sorry, but no, the college's responsibility is to protect students, to protect their safety. It is not the college's responsibility, it's not any institution's responsibility to protect students from ideas. And I think that it's fundamentally wrong as a learning institution to take any kind of stance. All of us hear things frequently that are hurtful or we disagree with, and sometimes make us fearful, but we can't limit freedom of expression, we can't limit the exchange of ideas because of fear of hearing something that, you know, that we disagree with or we don't like. We do have a First Amendment here, and it is that the freedom of expression is necessary and is a fundamental right.
Mm-hmm. And one other thing, and I know we're running out of time, one other thing that you mentioned that I thought was interesting at the town hall was that along with what people may consider more traditional minority groups or underrepresented, you know, along racial or socioeconomic lines groups, that you know, as you were crafting this policy, you kind of considered students of a more conservative political ideology, a group whose rights need to be protected in this philosophy. Can you kind of talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I'm really glad that you mentioned that, Ben, because I think that often gets lost. Even some of the students who were talking today still were talking about diversity, I think, in a very narrowly defined way. In our discussions with student groups, particularly with some of the conservative student groups, it became very, very clear that they feel minoritized on this campus, as conservative students do on many campuses, which came out at the town hall today as well. And so we need to think about diversity inclusion, meaning diversity of thought and inclusion of ideas, of politically conservative ideas, and in addition to thinking about historically underrepresented groups. That is sort of our default when we say minority and diversity. And I think that it was very, very important to us in crafting this philosophy. We got a lot of feedback from conservative students who feel sidelined and feel silenced on this campus. And they're very, very concerned that they are discriminated against. And I am sensitive to that. And this philosophy protects them in the same way that it protects any other student group or any other faculty member or any other staff member on this campus. They were very clear that they have been mistreated because of minority of opinion, I think.
Mm-hmm. And so the last question, I guess, is just kind of looking ahead. We know that there's a Google form that will continue to receive feedback through February 15th. And the link to that form was in a campus-wide email. I know it's also linked in an article that we published. And so you said the faculty will be discussing this at an upcoming faculty. Is that later today,
in fact? Yes, it is.
So you're having a busy afternoon, it seems like. But anyway, could you just kind of talk about, you know, once that talkback period ends, where do we go from here in terms of the ratification process?
So once the talkback period is over, so we'll have the Google form up for the next 2 weeks. People can also send documentation through campus mail if they'd like. I think the box number is 0410. The work group will be speaking this afternoon at the faculty meeting at 4:00. Once we complete the talkback period, and also in the next 2 weeks, if there are student groups or faculty groups or any group who want to talk more with us, we're available in the next 2 weeks. Reach out via email, that's fine. So once the 2 weeks are over, the hope is then if we have to make revision to the philosophy, we go ahead and make the revision and then send it to Student Senate. Student Senate, I believe, meets once a week. So when we can send it to Student Senate and they can discuss it and have a vote. If it passes the Student Senate vote, then it will be put on a future faculty meeting for a vote. And then if it passes the faculty vote, then it will go to the Board of Trustees. I think it's May 9th is the weekend that they're here. So it will go to the Board of Trustees. And once they vote on it and if they pass it, then it will be part of our institutional fabric. I'm not entirely sure of what the placement of it is, where it will live. Maybe it will be something at the beginning of each of the student, faculty, staff handbooks. I assume we'll probably have a link on our website. It'll be part of our institutional identity once we, as a group, as a community, have figured out what it looks like.
Professor Jennifer Blomquist, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Ben.
That's On Target for this week. We'd like to thank Dean Jennifer Blomquist for being our featured guest today.
We'd also like to thank the staff of the Gettysburgian and the executive board of WZBT for their support of this project. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and download it on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, or wherever else you get your podcasts. We were even recently named one of the top college podcasts by Player.fm.
On Target is a joint production of the Gettysburgian and WZBT. Our theme music was composed by Diego Rocha, of the class of 2019, who is a music major focusing on composition from the Sunderman Conservatory of Music.